You can probably go first this week since mine is with the Thanksgiving theme, since this is coming out the week of Thanksgiving.
It will be coming out the week of Thanksgiving because that's next week, right?
Yeah.
I don't
know. Last time I was doing it, I was thinking that there was still a spot between now and Thanksgiving.
Keep thinking that too.
But then I was like, no, I just edited and uploaded
for
this week, so I don't know why I'm thinking that at all. But anyway, I mean, mine isn't really Thanksgiving themed. It just is to me in my head.
That's okay.
And I'll say why whenever we whenever I tell mine.
Mine's not. And we already gave a little
precursor.
Prediction last week.
We're down to one microphone today, so if anything sounds weird.
So my story is about, I titled it Belvedere because it's the name of the property before it became other things, and the guy who owned the property was real wild, so I thought we just, and Belvedere's fun to say.
Okay.
Rather than saying, like, the story of the cemetery in this neighborhood. So my sources are HollywoodCemetery.org, Wikipedia, and RVAGhosts.com, which is like RichmondVirginiaGhosts.com. So we're going to start with Oregon Hill. So in the 1750s, William Byrd III started building his own personal fortress. I don't know why it was a fortress, but that's how someone described it, and I thought that was fun.
Interesting.
But, like, nothing about it seems fortressy. Either way, he builds this living space on the bluff overlooking the James River. I don't know if it was in Richmond, Virginia then, or just outside of Richmond, but, it, like, Richmond was baby then, so...
Hold on, let me go turn off the whatever's on, the heat or the air.
Yeah. So yeah, this, he has this property. It's definitely in modern day Richmond, Virginia, if it wasn't also part of Richmond, Virginia then. So Byrd spared no expense in the process of renovating a country house that was already standing on the property. So he just, like, gutted it, redid the exterior, the interior, all of it. He made it new and fancy and wonderful. He called this house and the property Belvedere. It he also owned the newly built Westover Plantation. I think the land had been in the family for a while, but he built, like, a big plantation mansion on it. At the same time, he was, like, redoing this Belvedere mansion. So he was putting a lot of money into a lot of spaces. So the Byrd estate was massive, and this is, I think, including everything that he owned, not just Belvedere and not just that plantation. He owned over 179,000 acres of land.
Jeez.
Hundreds of enslaved people, a number of fisheries, warehouses, boats, mills, and stores. So we had a lot of stuff. And therefore a lot of ways to technically make money.
Yeah.
He should be able to maintain it based on everything he has. He has diversified assets, right? So he's not, like, dependent on potatoes. In 1748, he marries Elizabeth Hill Carter, and together they had five children. In 1756, he disowned Elizabeth, and then she suddenly died in 1760, either by accident or suicide, at Westover.
What?
So, yeah, she disowned her, which means divorce without the divorce, because it's hard to get them back then.
No, I'm saying...
Oh, we'll get there.
Was it suicide?
We'll get there. Accident or suicide. So this is the story of her death.
Okay.
So some accounts say that she died from being crushed by a bureau, like a big, like an armoire, but
like them drawers. Kids do.
Yeah. You know, don't climb on furniture, kids.
I climbed on it and I was just fine.
I think you were little and we had a lot of very heavy furniture.
I think it's also because I was not stupid like other children. No.
You also didn't hang on it. Yeah, that's what, like, kids are usually doing when that. They're, like, hanging, like, and, like, pulling.
And then the parents take a video of it.
Mm-hmm. And then it falls. You were, like, scuttling up the top to get food.
I was a rock climber.
Yeah.
I have places to be.
It's so funny because you're so scared of heights now.
I know.
So anyway, her mother-in-law, who also lived at Westover, informed her that in the top drawers of this bureau, she would find a letter that would prove to her that Byrd had been... of Byrd's infidelity, that he was cheating on her. And so Elizabeth is like, I need to find that because this could actually get me divorced and not just in this weird disowned state, right? So Elizabeth is too short to reach the top of the bureau. So she removed a lower drawer to use as a step, which caused the bureau to fall on top of her and kill her.
So her mother-in-law killed her?
Well, it could be that it was like, oh, I know she'll do it. And then, like, maybe the bureau was even made more unsturdy so that it would, like, smash her. Or it could be an accident. Here's the one thing I don't think it is suicide. I think it's either an accident or murder.
Suicide is the most interesting one I've ever heard of in my life.
That does not seem like...
I'm going to go? I'm going to try and get this dresser to smash me to death.
And there's no guarantee that that'll kill you at all.
Because I know heavy, like, furniture is heavy, but, like, you're a grown adult woman. I find it hard to believe that you died by being crushed by a dresser.
Like, it's not that it can't happen, but still.
But it's very not plausible.
It's also surprising that it did fall because these are, like, such heavy pieces of furniture. Because
he's rich. It's not like he's got that cheap driftwood furniture.
Well, and even back then, they didn't make furniture out of cheap driftwood because there was so much hardwood plentifully available that it, like, wasn't as expensive.
Yeah.
A piece of furniture being expensive meant how many details were added to it, like carving details or, like, inlays, not the wood quality, unless it was, like a rainforest wood, you know?
That other table that we got for Thanksgiving and to replace our other one, we refinished it and everything, and I got this horrific splinter.
Is it still in there?
No, we got it out.
Oh, good.
It's just the boo-boo.
Oh.
But it was so long, and I saw it so in my finger. I was freaking out. I was like, I can't look at it, Drew. You have to take it out. I was literally holding it like this.
Touching wood.
I was like, Drew, you have to take it.
Like, raw wood, I do not like touching it at all.
But anyway, it's like the heaviest table I've ever lifted in my life.
It looks so cute, though.
And that's including the other giant, very nice wood table we have in our dining room. It is the heaviest thing. I don't understand it. And it was so hard to get moved into the house. But anyway, maybe that, if it's as heavy as that table and bigger, then it could crush you to death, I guess.
Anywho, so that's how his first wife died. A year later, in 1761, Bird married Mary Willing, and they had 10 children together.
Jeez!
So he was 15 children in total. And she died in 1771. In 1776...
She had 10 kids in that amount of time?
Yeah, she had a kid a year.
Oh, gee. No wonder why she died.
Yeah, she probably died in childbirth. I didn't look into it, because it wasn't really important to the rest of the story. In 1776, due to Bird's lavish spending, bad investments, and gambling addiction, he sold Belvedere to Daniel Hilton to pay off some of his debts. He also ended up selling most of, and this was not enough, he ended up selling off most of his land and all of his enslaved African laborers, most of his, like, shops, fisheries, boats. He was selling anything and everything he could sell, he was selling. I think the only thing that he was holding on to was the Westover Plantation House. Because technically Belvedere was, like, a vacation alternative, like, city home. And then in 1777, he committed suicide. He was 49. I think he had bad spending habits and could not get out of the debt. Despite other, resources were not discounting his ability to be a very effective businessman. He was good at maintaining the business and the land. It just... still wasn't enough money, like, there was not enough income to offset his spending habits. So after that, Belvedere changed hands a number of times until 1814, when William Anderson bought the house and used it as a boarding home. Like, it was a single family home until 1814, when it turned into a boarding house. And then in 1817, the plots around the house were sold off to create a community called Sydney. So, like, Belvedere, the house was made into an apartment complex, and then they made a whole bunch of little plots so that primarily it was not, like, normal people buying these plots for the most part. Most of the people buying it were Tredegar Ironworks, and they were buying the plots to build little cottages to use as, like, worker housing, so, like, the workers could rent the houses that the company owned so that they were stuck there forever. And then the house Belvedere burned down in 1854. After that, over time, the estate had been sold off for various purposes, different parcels here and there, and it's, most of it is now just generally parts of Richmond City, because this is an old property. It's like, you know, here, like, all the land the Shodos owned, which was, like, most of St. Louis. No one even considers thinking about that anymore because most of it was just loose land they never really did anything with. So one of the parcels that got sold off was to make Hollywood Cemetery, which is 135 acres of that original Belvedere estate. The cemetery was established in 1847 after some prominent citizens in Richmond were inspired by the Mount Auburn Cemetery in Boston. They too wanted a rural cemetery near the city, so that what by that they mean like sort of like an arboretum park style big rolling hills. You can forget you're in the city while you're walking through the cemetery.
The pretty walking cemeteries. Yeah,
you know, like Bellefontaine or Calvary here. Calvary.
I don't know.
Calvary is the religious one. Calvary's horses. But yeah, it was pretty.
That sounded the same to me.
And like, this is not quite Victorian era yet, but when they're getting those park cemeteries, they wanted one too. So they bought land from Lewis E. Harvey, who owned that portion at a time, for $4,075, which is about $152,956 now, which is a good deal. A good deal for what it was, undeveloped land. Like, it wasn't anything spectacular. So it's a garden cemetery. It's well landscaped. It's located on the bluff, like literally along the bluff overlooking the James River, and is a registered arboretum, which is like a tree museum. Now I'm going to list off notable people buried in the cemetery, because I like to do that with cemeteries.
Everybody does.
I have it separated into three parts. The first one is just random notable people. The second is specifically Confederate generals or higher-ranking people in the Confederacy. And then the third group is women's suffrage / women's rights leaders.
They were allowed in the same cemetery as the Confederate men.
A lot of them were married to some of the Confederate men.
Interesting.
So, James Dandridge. James Dandridge Halliburton was a judge in the U.S.
name.
And the Confederacy. Like, he was a federal judge for both countries. John Harvey was a delegate to the Continental Congress and a signer of the Articles of Confederation. Hunter McGuire was a Confederate Army surgeon who amputated Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson's arm.
Did he keep it?
No, it's buried in the cemetery. He's also the founder of the Virginia College of Medicine. Matthew Fontaine Murray was an oceanographer, scientist, author, and the first superintendent of the U.S. Navy Observatory. Hmm. And that was in, like, 1843 or something when the U.S. Navy Observatory opened. I don't know what that is. In my mind, they look at fish there, but I think it's for boats. James Monroe, the fifth president of the United States, is buried there. Elizabeth Kittredge Moore, his wife, so the first lady, is buried there. A bunch of Virginia governors, like so many, a whole bunch of congressmen from Virginia, a whole bunch of judges from Virginia. I didn't bother to list them all because nobody knows them. William Wartworth Poole.
Wartham?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
William Wartham Poole.
He's not necessarily notable for himself, but his tomb is specifically connected to the Richmond Vampire, which we'll get to later. David Gardner Tyler, who was one of the sons, I think he's the fifth son of President John Tyler. Lion Gardner Tyler, the seventh son of John Tyler, who's the one who has a kid that's still alive now. Lion Gardner Tyler. John Tyler, 10th President of the United States. Julia Gardner Tyler, his wife. So, first
all
lady.
All the Tylers.
I don't think that's his first. I think he had more than one wife. I don't know which number of wife it is. And then the last just person is Prince Sergei Volkonsky, who was an influential Russian theatrical worker. And I tried for the life of me to figure out what specifically he was famous for. And it was such obscure, like, theater terms.
Why is
that
he
I had
named Prince?
Because he's a prince.
Oh.
Because he had, it's a title, not a name.
Well, yeah, but, like, why is he buried in a Virginia?
Because it was not a very good prince.
I guess not.
Like, they didn't
want him back.
They didn't want him back. Well, and it's not, he's not like a prince who can become a king. He's like a prince by, like, principality title kind of thing. Like one of those little, he's obviously Russian and not German, but like the German principalities have a lot of princes that'll never be kings and would never be kings, but they get that title for some reason. I don't know how it works. Next list is the Confederate generals or higher. So yeah, most of these are just some form of general. So there's James J. Archer, Lloyd James Beale, Robert H. Chilton, Philip St. George Cock, Raleigh Edward Colston, John Roger Cook, Jabez Lamar Monroe Curry, Jefferson Davis, as in the president of the Confederacy, Verena Howell Davis, his wife, so the first lady, Richard B. Garnett, Walter Gwynn, Henry Heth, Ep Hunton, John D. Imboden, Edward John Johnson.
I'm trying to figure that out myself.
That's not a hard word.
I was like, that's not a hard one.
David Rumpf Jones.
Who would say that? Who wouldn't keep that name?
Rumpf. It's his middle name.
That's a legit middle name? Apparently. I thought he had two last names or something.
Samuel Jones. It's probably like his mom's maiden name is his middle name. Samuel Jones, Fitzhugh Lee, Thomas M. Logan, Samuel P. Moore, John Pegram, George Pickett, James Alexander Seddon, William E. Stark, Walter Husk Stevens, Isaac M. St. John, J.E.B. Stewart, William R. Terry, Reuben Lindsay Walker, Henry A. Wise, and over 18,000 Confederate soldiers, plus an additional, potentially, 11,000 more that may or may not be buried on site, and they're just not sure. Because, like, there's one mass grave with the 18,000, and there might be an additional mass grave with the 11, and they just aren't sure.
Yeah.
In general, it's they don't bother to dig up cemeteries unless they're removing cemeteries, so... So there's a lot of Confederates buried there, which makes sense. It is Richmond, Virginia. This is not, it's not like we're in, you know, Wisconsin.
Not a Union area.
And then the women's suffrage / women's rights people. There's Kate Langley Bosher, Mary Johnston, Mary Cook, Branch Munford. Her whole name is Mary, her first name, Mary
Branch.
Cook. It's Mary Cook as her first name.
Mary Branch Cook, is her middle Branch name. Mumford.
Yeah. Mary Cook, Branch Mumford, and then Lila Mead Valentine. And I know it's only four of them, but it was enough to be like, the women deserve a section too.
Yeah.
most of those people I have never heard of before, but, you know, just in case someone out there is like, oh my gosh, they mentioned them, you know?
Yeah, the Confederates, I hope no one's excited about that.
No, but, like, now you, if you're a history buff, specifically Civil War related, and you're like, oh my gosh, I've heard of all those generals, that's why I just did the generals and not, like, anybody else.
Get a new hobby.
Like, fighting other, you know, people that I know, then... there's a 90-foot tall stone pyramid, which is apparently an architectural marvel, because it has no,
it was built like the Egyptian pyramids.
It has no grout. It's just sort of loose stacking that worked. Somebody did it really well. And the somebody that did it was prisoners. Prison labor was built used to build this stone
just
pyramid.
Just like, yeah, hey, just like Egypt.
So, yeah, it was built in 1869 to mark the mass grave, the 18,000 Confederate soldiers. That's their grave marker, is this 90-foot tall stone pyramid built by prisoners. And if... the war gone a different way, it would have been prisoners. So the paranormal things based around this tomb. That's how we're going to do this now. We're just going to go location, paranormal story. So this was the first location, is this 90-foot tall stone pyramid. So people report around the base of the pyramid feeling like weird bursts of cold air, which just like shouldn't happen because you're in like Virginia and that's hot in the south. but they're also on a bluff where you can get bursts of cold air off of the river, and I don't think people realize that. So it's not the best paranormal thing, but that's one of the things connected to it. They also hear whispering in ears.
No.
Hate that. And they also have disembodied moans that one can hear that are reported from, like, they're only around the pyramid from at dawn and dusk. They're never reported any other time, these weird moans, which is interesting.
Could be an animal.
Probably is.
That's only out at those times.
And, yeah, it's like literally deer making weird noises. Like, people don't, all the videos I see of like I'm in the woods and I hear this blood curdling scream and you'll hear it and you're like, it's an elk.
Yeah.
It's a moose. It's a deer. Oh, that's a mountain lion. You need to leave. But like, people don't know what noises animals make. Unless they're farm animals.
Well, it doesn't make sense because it always seems like people who are in the woods normally.
Literally, that's what's so confusing to me.
Out of all the times you've been there, you've never interacted with those noises.
Yeah.
Or like Googled what are the noises of an animal that might attack me in the woods.
I don't get it either, but it's a common problem. So next little story. In 1862, a 2-year-old girl was buried in the cemetery. There's nothing particularly special about her or her death, or even her family, but what is special is that her family did choose a special grave marker for her, and they're not entirely sure how the family got their hands on this, because it was during the Civil War when iron was really, really hard to come by, but they think it was like some weird payment by somebody.
Yeah.
For something else in life, not necessarily shady or not, but that was just like... well, I can pay you with this. And then they said, what a great grave marker for my child. And the grave marker in question is a life-size cast iron Newfoundland dog, which is an awesome grave marker.
That's great.
For anybody.
That's what I want.
But she did not have a Newfoundland dog. There's no connection to why
That's
she would
weird.
Have a Newfoundland dog. That's why they think it's just like a weird gift the family received,
yeah.
or a weird payment for something the family received. It is notable that they decided to use that much iron as...
yeah.
when it was so expensive. They could have gotten good money for it. Either way.
Or don't you think somebody, like, might have tried to take it and melt it down?
Well, it seems to be shockingly haunted, so I understand why they didn't.
Okay.
So, yeah, this grave marker, haunted. That's why we're talking about it. The bark of a dog has been reported coming from the area when no dogs are nearby. And it's coming from, like, over there. It's not, like, somewhere in the cemetery. It's, like, the dog, the metal dog is barking. But it doesn't sound metal. Like,
I was going to say, the reverb on that thing has got to be crazy.
More specifically, if someone's in the cemetery that has, like, bad motives, because people go and they'll do bad things in cemeteries, they go near the dog, they'll hear, like, a deep growling emanating from the grave.
It's a good guard dog.
What if that's why they gifted the statue
it's
to begin
haunted
with?
In there.
Is
that
the entire
it's like a family
time?
Heirloom that got passed down for years and
yeah,
it's haunted
like,
and
the,
they go, know
the
it.
Statue is haunted. They said, oh my gosh, I have a great option. Their kid just died. It's tragic. I'm going to give them this. I bet you they'll use it to a grave marker. We never have to think about it again, and it's serving a good purpose.
That'd be so
funny.
Either way,
so it'll growl at bad people
who
are going
to the grave.
I'm surprised
Zach Bacon's hasn't tried to get his hands on that.
Right? it's mauled to death by a ghost in Finland. And it's also said that the statue will change positions from time to time, like turning around completely. Like, not like its face is doing something different, but like it facing south normally, now it's facing north. Like,
weird.
Which is bizarre, and I assume that's not what's ever happening, but... That's the haunted dog statue, which is adorable. I love that it's purely aggressive, but not, like, mean.
It says, get your butt out of here.
And then the last story, which I did not expect to cover, it was going to be, like, a separate thing later. I knew this story existed, but I didn't mean to cover it today. But honestly, it's not that long of a story, so it was okay to cover. It worked out better this way. And that is of the Richmond Vampire's tomb. That, you know, of the pool tomb that we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
So the Richmond Vampire is an urban legend that started in the 1960s. And, like, they have, like, pretty good record of it starting then, like, because it was a newspaper-based one, I think. There are multiple versions of the story, most of which link the Churchill Railroad Tunnel and the WW Pool Mausoleum. Those are two, like, common themes. And it also... and the reason specifically that the WW Pool Mausoleum is in these stories at all is because the W's on it look like vampire fangs.
Oh.
I'm not even joking. That's why it's connected. They all look right. like vampire fangs. And that's why they chose this one. So the story goes that an ancient evil was released when the Churchill Tunnel collapsed and a monster covered in blood with skin hanging off its body and jagged teeth ran out of the tunnel towards the James River, going through the Hollywood Cemetery to get to the James River. And then people were following this monster. They're like, what the heck is that? And they're following it, right? And then they lost sight of it. And where they lost sight of it was around the WW Pool tomb. And they assumed that he'd, like, gone. That's where he lived. He was returning to his second home, the WW Pool tomb.
From the tunnel to the tomb.
Yeah, those were just, yeah, vacation home, standard home, you know. And then... what I don't understand about this specific story is that the location of the Churchill Tunnel and the location of the cemetery, the river's not in, like, the straight line to the river is not through the cemetery at all. That's a significantly longer distance to run, so I don't know why anybody would have made that route to go towards the James River through the cemetery. But that's besides the point, and really only matters once I tell you more about what the story might be based off of. So some folklore researchers who've looked into this vampire story have linked it to a possible horrific death. And I say possible because I'm not sure if this man was real or if this is how he died, because I didn't look into it, but it could 100% be true. But it would be the death of Benjamin F. Mosby, who escaped the Churchill Tunnel after collapse in 1925. He had been shoveling coal into a steam locomotive that was going through the tunnel with no shirt on because it's hot doing that job. And then the tunnel collapsed all of a sudden. I don't know why exactly. Anyway, the collapse caused the boiler to explode, and he's next to the boiler. That's his job, is to keep the boiler going. Mosby managed to survive the blast and run out of the tunnel with his upper body scalded, so his skin would be hanging off, and his teeth broken from the blast, so he would have jagged teeth, and he would be covered in blood, because his skin's falling off of himself. And he ran in the direction of the river, because he knew that was the closest water source, and he knows he is on fire, basically. He later died in Grace Hospital. He never ran to the cemetery, because that, again, is not the closest route at all. But he is, funnily enough, buried in Hollywood Cemetery.
Interesting.
So the person who may be the vampire, like the root of that story, is in fact actually in the cemetery, but just not in the WW Pool Mausoleum.
Interesting. So I've never heard of that.
Yeah, that's the weird history of just this Belvedere estate space. There's a few things where it's like Oregon Hill is like one of the most haunted locations in Richmond. And then like all the stories were just the things in the cemetery, but the cemetery is separate from Oregon Hill. They're immediately next to each other, but you wouldn't like say, but like if you were in like Bellefontaine Cemetery, you wouldn't say the entirety of like, I don't think Bellefontaine is in Bellefontaine Cemetery, but like if they were immediately next to each other, you wouldn't call that entire town haunted because it was next to the big cemetery. You know?
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't... Yeah, Jennings isn't there, yeah. You would be able to say Bellefontaine isn't haunted because Bellefontaine Cemetery is there. You don't say a town is haunted because within it exists something haunted. You can say it's haunted if multiple places in the space are haunted, but it's just, like, the one.
Yeah.
But, like, there were no specific stories for Oregon Hill itself, which is why I started with that. And then at that point, I was like, well, we can at least get some of the weird history from this crazy guy. And then I'll tell you about the cemetery. And then eventually a vampire. The entire time I was writing, I was just like, not as it felt like, you know, like one of those Wikipedia deep dives where you just keep clicking through and clicking through in Wikipedia. And I wasn't clicking through Wikipedia. This was just like the story of the area. It's just like this.
So weird. All right. So now on to my Thanksgiving-ish themed in my mind story. we do have one more follower on Spotify. Oh, now we have 35 followers.
Thank you, follower.
Can't believe that. I'm probably the only person that is excited for having one singular more person.
Well, considering that we barely expect anyone to listen to it.
Yeah.
It's exciting that 35 people might be listening to it.
Here, let me pull. Is that called Egg?
And some of them have to be strangers. Because I don't think I know 35 people.
Well, I don't know people in Australia, and I don't think they would just make up that there's people in Australia listening.
Unless they're really dedicated to, like, a VPN.
So today, my story is about witchcraft in colonial Virginia. And now the only reason that I feel, to me, this is a Thanksgiving story is because when I think of the colonial people, I just think of Thanksgiving. That's all I think about.
I feel like I've had to have told this story on here before, but did I ever tell you about the time that I broke into the governor's mansion?
I don't think so.
It's not the current one. And it wasn't, like, in an illegal sense. It was more in the sense of, like, I accidentally skirted security and went on a tour because they just let me. of the governor's mansion in Williamsburg.
No, I don't think you told me that.
So we were in Williamsburg when I was living in New Jersey, and I went with some of, like, the other students down to a little conference that was being held down there. And we were walking around, and we had paid for, like, the bare minimum ticket to go. The way Williamsburg works is, like, the historic houses are, like, rides at a fair. You have to pay to get in each one. But you can, like, pre-buy X amount of tickets.
Yeah.
And then certain things are an even more important ticket. So, like, the governor's mansion in a different, bigger mansion space. And we're like, we're not that interested. And we're also poor college students. We're not going to pay that much. We're going to get the bare minimum ticket and, like, go into a few of the more interesting spaces.
Yeah.
So then we were just, like, walking around the space otherwise, because you can just walk around the little old historic site. And we went down, like, this back alleyway, which you can totally go down, and came to this, like, garden entrance. And there was, like, you know, a lady who works there standing there. And I'm like, can we just look at the gardens through here? And they're like, yeah, you can just look through at the gardens through here. But, like, the right number of gates within the gardens had been left open that as we continued through the gardens to the governor's mansion, we made it to the front where the line is to get into the governor's mansion. And they were like, come on, come on. It's the last tour of the day. And we're like, okay. You're not checking tickets. Because we missed the part where you check tickets because you're supposed to go through this other gate to check the tickets. But we were already in, like, the space where you should have been, like, your ticket should be checked to be in it, basically. So then we got to go on a free tour. The governor's mansion. Never pay to go into that building. It is, one, entirely rebuilt, and they don't make that very, very clear, and they're actually making up what the entire interior looks like because it burned down. And they're doing a bad job of it.
Jeez.
I'm not a fan of that space. Williamsburg is cool otherwise, but don't pay to go in the governor's mansion.
So, I got my information from encyclopediavirginia.org, wikipedia.org, and then colonialghosts.com. So here is, like, the history, and then it's basically all history. This is like a history lesson today, everybody. So, the English colonists... This is just going to start from, like, literally when they got here.
How much spook is real?
Sorry. You tell me, Germans. You tell me. That's too funny. I know. We'll have to do more stories in those places because...
Well, especially since we can.
Yeah.
Specifically Germany and Australia. I know. I don't know
what he was watching. But there was something. Oh, it was the Chiefs football game when they played in Germany. And there was, like, a part where they were, like, having the German announcers. And I'm just sitting there and I was like, I understand a lot more German than I thought I did. Like, I only took it for 4 years in high school and I did not take it seriously. Like, the teachers were not very hard on this. Like, I didn't actually learn the language at all. But I was like, I guess I understood more.
I think German's a very understandable language.
I think so.
And here's how much I think that... And it's,
well, not if you've never been introduced to any of the words.
Well, that's, like, one thing. But you've been introduced to a lot of the base words, and then you really sit down, and if you've broken down a few words just, like, because you've had to from time to time, you're like, oh, wait, there's really simple rules, and a lot of it is really actually similar to English.
Yeah.
But, like, when they're dubbing movies into German, like there's a movie that's not in German, they want it to be in German, and they're dubbing it. If they're financing other foreign films, so like say if Norway is making a movie and they want some German financing to make this movie, sometimes Germany will request that they film it in English, even though it's supposed to be a Norwegian film. And so, like, that happened to Kon-Tiki, the movie. They filmed it twice, the entire movie twice, once spoken entirely in English and the other time spoken entirely in Norwegian, because that was supposed to be who it was made for, because the Germans find it easier to dub over English, which means there has to be some major similarities, in my opinion, if the dubbing looks that much better with it being in English and not another Germanic dialect, like, language.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that Norwegian looks that much different compared to English is very interesting to me. And I mean, other than the fact that they're root languages, they're literally very physically related. They're very similar.
Okay, anyway. So, the English colonists who came to Virginia in 1607 had long believed in the reality of witchcraft. Witch trials had been a part of English life for centuries, as I feel like most people know. Mm-hmm. And Parliament had passed a law criminalizing the practice of witchcraft in 1542. So, all of the new settlers at Jamestown would have considered witchcraft to be, you know, terrible and punishable and whatever.
Yep. Big no-no.
So, they, of course, believed that the Indians they encountered were devils or devil worshippers. And their description of Virginia Indians, the Jamestown colonists often used supernatural terms. John Smith described the... How do you say that one?
Which one?
Powhatan?
Yeah.
James, or John's, why am I saying James Smith? There's like three Jameses in here again.
Okay, there's a lot of Jameses.
I don't remember what other story I did when it was
so many Jameses.
Every husband was named James or something. So John Smith described the Powhatan chief as, quote, more like a devil than a man. And I thought that was funny because I'm sitting here like, and why would he know that? I was sitting here like, the Connors should be more concerned that John Smith knows so much what a devil is.
Right.
That he would say that. But anyway, so George Percy wrote about the Indians, quote, making noise like so many wolves or devils. It just cracks me up how stupid these people are. Okay, and then Alexander Whitaker, an Anglican minister, I was going to say Anglican, said he found the Indians to be, quote, very familiar with the devil, and observed, quote, their priests are no other than such as our English witches are. And I'm just like, okay, so how much time are you spending with the devil and witches that you would know this?
That you know this.
Like, that's all I'm seeing from other witches. Yeah, I'm like, that's all I'm seeing from this. And I'm like, you guys should be more concerned that the people you're following know the devil and witches so well. If you think it's so illegal, spend a lot of time with them. So they believed this partially because of the colonists' interpretation of the Powhatans' religious beliefs and rituals. Because some of the colonists believed that the Powhatan's main deity, Oki, I think that's how you say it, was the devil incarnate. But I'm also like, you guys obviously, like, you don't speak the same language. So I'm like, I don't, and you know that other languages exist.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Anyway, and partially due to the fact that they had never seen anybody who looked like them before, like, at all. Which, fair enough with that one, you know. Back then, nobody had met each other. They don't know.
They don't know what the rest of the world looks like.
Yeah,
everything is painting.
So historian Edward L. Bond wrote, "Quote: Colonial aspects of native colonial accounts of native bodies carried implications beyond mere physical descriptions. For English philosophy and theology linked body and spirit by suggesting that the exterior appearance of the body gave evidence of the interior state of the soul." Which, like, I had never heard of that before, but it kind of makes sense for back then, you know, back then thinking.
And they didn't know what germs were.
Yeah. They didn't bathe. They didn't wash
their hands. What's really something to remember is that a lot of the more recent, like, culty Christian sects, like Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormonism, hold dear to that principle still, that your exterior is... Like you really? Having darker skin, darker complexion, is related to the level of unholiness, and that if you actually truly, like, and they don't, none of them admit it anymore, but it's still in their doctrines.
Yeah.
But that idea that your external pureness is, like, visible.
Ew.
Which is really weird to me when so many, like, white people aren't parts of their religion, but they still, like, avidly try to convert them. You know, well, like, wouldn't that technically, if that was true, wouldn't that mean whatever they're doing, they're living a holy life?
I don't know.
But,
well, because, like, for back then at this time, you can understand the way that they, like, their thought process, it doesn't excuse the way they treated different people, but, you know, you can understand because they have never known anything different than what they were taught. And it's like they were in a cult.
No, very much
because
so.
Because back then, when you don't know anybody outside your country,
you've never seen anything other than maybe a picture book if you're
Well, these lucky. People were a little bit more educated. The ones that first got sent over, weren't they? Or were they just, like, test dummies?
No, they're all test dummies.
Then that makes even more sense.
That's why it was, like, such a big deal when, in 1849, when there's a whole bunch of revolutions in Germany, a lot of the people who were... revolting, they were the revolutionaries. When the revolution wasn't successful, they came over here in mass, and they were, like, insanely educated.
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of the Germans that came to St. Louis were these 49ers who spoke, like, five languages and were all had college educations, and that was, like, an insane thing that many highly educated people came all at once to the U.S.
Yeah.
Which means up until 1849, that was not the standard to be that educated to come over to the U.S. It was not that standard to be that educated in general. People don't know things. It's not an excuse, but it's worth knowing.
Yeah. Well, it's like I said, I've never heard that before.
Yeah, no.
The exterior, interior kind of thing.
I didn't realize that. I knew this was a thing that people did believe. I did not know there was such a big thing then with that population, the Jamestown population in Virginia.
And I've never seen the things that they wrote before.
Like?
The devil things.
No, I haven't seen that either.
So I just thought this was interesting. It's a learning moment for everyone, okay? Yeah. Which, it's something that it's like, I feel like so many people just don't even care that the people that know. They're like, well, they should have just known better. How would they have known better?
And this is, everybody thinks that way then. Yeah, there's nobody exactly. who teach them these things. And again, not excusing anything. But
well, that's what I said. It's not okay to treat people a certain way, but at the same time, they literally had no knowledge of anything different. And then they still did it for the rest of their lives, mm-hmm. you know? So anyway, and it's not even like all the people were bad. There's one guy in here. I don't know if I really mentioned him by name, but he's one of the people that like stood up for the Indians and everything.
And we've mentioned people in the past yeah. during this time period and other things we've covered. We're so, like that one Puritan that got kicked out because he was like, why aren't we chill with everybody? Yeah. And then like created his own cult.
Yeah.
But it was like a chill cult.
So Puritan minister William Crashaw wrote in 1613, quote, Satan visibly and palpably rages in Virginia
oh.
more than in any other known place of the world.
Fascinating.
Which like, okay, minister, have you been to every place in the world?
No, he has not.
You did not.
Oh, sorry. That's the dehydrator's done.
End quote. It was easier for the colonists to connect with Indians' unfamiliar appearance and religion to their traditional understandings of demonology than to accept that their worldview was so different from everything they've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
Which, that makes sense. Your people are in denial, and they lash out when they're in mm-hmm. denial. Let's see here.
There's also, like, a lot of, like, generational religious trauma in Europe where it's, like, if mm-hmm. you practiced any of the old non-Christian ways, like, the Spanish
yeah, because Inquisition they,
came and got you and burned you at the
yeah,
stake.
Yeah, they used to be able to have, you know, freedom of religion, and they did all these different kinds of things, but then Christianity and things, came
like,
and
like, cracked
they said
down
no.
viciously. So there's a lot of, like, other is bad,
if
other
I go
is bad,
against
you
it,
get killed
just
with your
dead.
Other.
Yeah. And then it's a them or me situation, mm-hmm. you know?
Oh, of course. That's always the happy issue.
And especially when you can't communicate,
yeah.
you'd rather be the people that you don't know anything about. So the early English interpretation of native life in Virginia supported the widespread belief that the practice of witchcraft was, quote, most common in the wild parts of the world. As the Scottish King James, what's IV, 5?
IV is 4.
Four wrote in his 1597 study demonology, but spelled in the old English way. I was like, demonology.
Here's the thing, that statement is not wrong when you consider what
becomes,
the definition of witchcraft is.
He becomes the James, King James, that they named Jamestown after. I'm pretty sure that's the right
yeah.
one. I don't know anything about it. They were like, Scottish king, but later English king. And I'm like, I don't care.
Is that also the King James Bible one?
Probably.
The one where it's just propaganda that he was like, he wanted to do whatever he wanted. So this church said, we'll look the other way if you let us write our own Bible that suits our needs best. So by the way, if you use that one, that's its purpose. It is entirely propaganda.
More than likely. So around 1622, once the Virginia colony had stabilized and its English population grew, which it's like, I can't remember how long it started taking before they started having a bunch of people come over. Do you know?
Well, the first few years, they were just dying.
Yeah.
Like, they were lucky when it, like they were literally cannibalizing each uh-huh. other, not killing them to eat them. But when you did happen to die,
yummy.
You were getting eaten.
But anyway, so the colonists began to turn their suspicions inwards. They were no longer focusing their, you know, assumptions of devil worshipping on the Indians, but on each other.
Because they were eating each other.
They were getting like that mad cow disease or whatever you get from eating
people.
They're
getting kuru from eating people's
brains. Is
that
what it is? I don't, mad cow disease. I don't know the
difference.
Mad cow
disease is from cows.
Well, I know that, but it's like the same kind of thing.
It is the same kind of thing, though. You're
so
correct.
So most of Virginia's colonial era court records were actually destroyed in the fires during the Civil War. The American Civil War. I made sure to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was on purpose or just because people were burning down, you know, towns.
Depending on where they were kept, they could have just been burnt down.
So it is unknown.
Know, Stonewall was raising the South,
yeah.
so.
So it's unknown how many witchcraft cases were actually held
not
in
Stonewall.
Virginia and when.
Who
I don't know.
How's going to bother me?
Then Google it. Historians know about two dozen cases that dealt with witchcraft in colonial Virginia. And then I saw something somewhere else that it was like there were around 33 that were just well known enough that it was still known. Without record, there were like 33 total in Virginia throughout history that they know of. So most of these cases were defamation suits from slander or gossip. The only Virginia law to specifically address witchcraft passed in Lower Norfolk County on May 23rd, 1655, and it was intended to eliminate, quote, diverse, dangerous, and scandalous speeches raised by some persons concerning several women in this county, terming them to be witches, whereby their reputations have been much impaired and their lives brought in question. Sorry, that was hard to read It was in Old English.
Yeah, that's
so I had to figure out what each things were. And then this one, I did not figure out until now as I was reading. I was like, what does pissins mean? So, false accusers were to pay a fine of 1,000 pounds of tobacco and could be further punished by the court if deemed necessary. Which I was going to look up what that would even cost or, like, what even...
What 1,000 pounds of tobacco means?
Yeah.
I have no
idea. In today's money. That seems like a lot.
Seems like a lot. What if you don't
What does an average tobacco? Person have that much?
No.
So anyway.
That's a lot of tobacco.
In criminal witchcraft cases, Virginia courts went by England's witchcraft law.
Yeah.
Which was a 1604 statute passed under James the First. I think it's the same James guy. This is law. Quote, an act against conjuration, witchcraft, and dealing with evil and wicked spirits. So that's what that was. In Virginia, most cases dealt with the charge of
maleficium.
Causing harm to people or property by supernatural means. The earliest witchcraft allegations on record against an English settler in the British North American colonies were made in Virginia in September 1626. The accused was Joan Wright of James City County.
So that means she lived near Jamestown, but not in Jamestown.
She was a married woman and a midwife. Many of her neighbors testified against her, saying that through witchcraft, she had caused the death of a newborn, killed crops and livestock, and accurately predicted the deaths of other colonists, which I thought that was hilarious.
I think that's so funny, because that's like so-and-so's walking down the street, has a terrible, terrible cough, you're like, they're going to be dead
they're
in a week.
Be dead soon.
And then they keel over because they obviously had pneumonia, and they're like, it's a witch!
Witch! That's the only way I imagine people accusing other people of witches is just screaming witch at them in the streets. Or like that scene in The Princess Bride where it's like that, does she call her a witch when she goes up to her? I can't remember.
Oh, I don't remember, but I know what you mean.
That's how I pictured them accusing each other. She was acquitted, although she admitted she had knowledge of witchcraft practices, which they said that like it made her a witch. And I was like,
now,
just because you know anything about, you know, like herbs.
We went over this when we did the witch episode for whatever Halloween
and
that
most
was.
Midwives were considered witches.
Yeah, midwives and herbalists, both absolutely necessary things in society. When people got a little pissy, were accused as being witches because they could do things that people thought you shouldn't be able to do, like make sure you didn't bleed to death or die of tum tum ache.
So the charges against Wright were typical of many witch trials during the colonial period. They loved to assume an unpopular member of the community for anything that went wrong in the society. Like, the weather was bad that day. You're a witch. My crop died because I'm not a good farmer. You're a witch.
Like, it flooded. So let's go kill the nearest woman I don't like.
So it was also more typical that most people being accused of being a witch were women, of course, because men hate women and they get to be in
charge
for no reason.
Especially those uppity ones that are independent.
In the surviving records of witchcraft cases in Virginia, only two accused witches were men, which one of which, I don't think I mentioned him by name, but like I said, one of which was a guy that stood up for the Native Americans, the Indians, and nobody liked that, of course.
Witch.
So he's gotta be a witch. This was a trend among England and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, both just accusing you for anything.
Oh, yeah.
Anything that went wrong, it's your fault, and you're a woman, so you're a witch.
So
you're a woman, you're unmarried. Ooh, witch. So,
even most of them are married.
You have a wart on your nose, witch.
You're kind of ugly, witch. So, or you didn't say hi to me when
you
I walked past.
You have lazy eye and your hair is red. Oof.
Yeah. You're left-handed.
You have concussion.
So the most famous witch trial in colonial Virginia was that of Grace Sherwood of Princess Anne County. She was born in Pungo, Virginia, in 1660 to Susan White and her husband John White, who was a carpenter. She was first accused by her neighbors in 1698 of having, quote, bewitched their pigs to death and bewitched their cotton.
I love that.
So she and her husband James brought defamation suits against the accusers, but did not win either case. James died in 1701, so she had to care for the farm and her three kids alone. She never remarried, so she was often criticized, ridiculed, and treated with hostility. She would regularly wear men's clothing when she was working on the farm because
it's practical.
That's what, you know, pants.
Because, you know,
and
pants.
She was also an herbalist because it's back then, and I feel like everybody should have been.
And it's true. Everyone, yeah. If they didn't have aspirin in the store, you had to go make it on your own from a willow branch. Like,
where was I? Oh, so in 1705, she sued her neighbors, Luke and Elizabeth Hill, for assault and battery, and she actually won that and received £20 sterling in damages. The rumors and accusations continued, though, until 1706, when Sherwood stood trial before the general court. After a long investigation, the court justices decided to use the water test to determine her guilt or innocence. So this test was so controversial at the time that it was no longer even used in any European on the European continent at all. Like, nowhere in Europe was using this test anymore because they were like, well, people do float. they were like, that man did float, and a lot of women saw it, so we can't use that test anymore. Where was I? So this involved binding the accused hands and feet and throwing them into a body of water. If you sank, you were innocent. But because this is why, which I had never actually seen the why, it's because the water is a pure element and had accepted them. But if they floated, they were guilty because the pure element is not accepting them.
Because rejecting them. So oil is evil.
But I'm like, so shouldn't, yeah, that's true. But I'm like, so shouldn't like the water throw the person out if you're rejecting it that bad?
You know
how
funny that would be?
Like,
if you jumped in and water really did work that way and you were guilty and they just launched you.
Well, that's why, like, I feel like either way the water's accepting you if they're allowing you to be in the water.
Yeah.
If it's an element that you can, they know it moves. They don't really know how, I don't think, at this time. They kind of do, but not really.
I think, but some then it's also do, like,
isn't water
don't.
Witchcraft?
Water's witchcraft.
It moves on its own.
You know what's even more witchcraft?
And it
though?
Gets
fire.
Angry.
I don't understand fire. I don't understand it all. Fire is witchcraft.
Witchcraft. So anyway, they threw her, which is also like, so if you're using this kind of technique to determine if someone's a witch or not, then wouldn't Native American practices that you witness be less like witchcraft? Because they don't, I'm not saying that Native Americans were testing witches, but like the things they do make sense.
The problem is their definition of magic has to do with things that are something that they don't do, not... They're doing magic all the time. Most religion has magic in it. Prayer is magic.
Yeah.
The problem is Native Americans are doing things that are not things they do. That's not the accepted magic. Okay. Does that make
but
sense?
But I'm like, wouldn't you see similarities?
No, they're refusing to. They're choosing not to on purpose.
Anyway,
that's why some people are like, they're just people, guys.
Yeah, that's true. And that's true. So anyway, they threw her into the Lynnhaven River, and she was floating. Her body was then examined a second time by a group of women who found two marks on her body, which,
like
if you would check mine, man,
marks.
They'd be like, that's the devil.
She's a witch.
Because I literally have one
you have
here.
So many moles.
I have here. I got all the birthmarks. Where is that one? There.
Mine's right here.
I also have the one back here still. And it still gets really red, especially if I went to the
I
gym.
I never had that one as bad as you and Sawyer did.
Mine still, like, stays extremely red.
So yours
and I'm
gets
like,
really
that
red,
is
too.
Ridiculous. So anyway, she was convicted and imprisoned, but by 1714, she was already released, so she didn't spend, like, a ton of time in prison. She lived out her days on her farm until she died in 1740. So she didn't get to live a pretty long life not being incarcerated. But I can, you know, she's still being treated bad because she was deemed a witch by the court. And nobody liked her to begin with for some reason. So no person in colonial Virginia was ever executed for witchcraft. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, however, 19 quote-unquote witches were executed in 1692 alone. Some historians said the death of Catherine Grady, who was hanged in 1654, counted as a Virginia execution for witchcraft. But Grady's trial took place, her trial and death took place at sea on a ship bound for the colony. So it doesn't like count as being in Virginia. And it wasn't the same people doing the courts, I would assume. So the last witchcraft trial on record in Virginia took place in 1730. One article said it was 1733. I'm not totally sure. So 5 years before this was, if it was 1730, then it was 5 years before Parliament repealed the English statute against witchcraft. Justices charged a woman named Mary with using witchcraft to find lost items and treasure. Sorry, it's not funny that they're being convicted for these crimes. It's just funny that they're coming up with these things. So she was convicted and whipped 31 times.
Oh my.
This was likely the last criminal case of witchcraft tried in any of the mainland colonies, but they aren't totally sure. That same year, Benjamin Franklin published in the Pennsylvania Gazette a satirical report of a witch trial in New Jersey. His mocking descriptions of the practices of court justices in trying witches illustrate the beginning of a shift in the colonial perception of witchcraft from terrifying reality to puritanical fantasy. I don't know if that's the right word.
No, that'd be
but
right.
Anyway, isn't it weird to think that Benjamin Franklin was alive when they were still doing witch trials?
Yeah.
Why wasn't he tried?
Right?
He literally made electricity.
Doing electricity. No, well, didn't make it.
Well, he created the use of it.
One, I mean, him doing those experiments also wasn't witchcraft actually too. Him. If he made it, that might make him a god, but...
maybe he was.
No, I think it was like an assistant, but he was the one.
I was going to say, I thought it was somebody else before him that technically did, but Imagine. Never got like the credit for it.
Ma'am! Smacked my toe a whole bunch.
So, by the turn of the 18th century, witchcraft cases had mostly disappeared from court records in Virginia. Virginia's witch trials were eventually overshadowed by the cases tried in New England, of course, since they were more, and they were, like, way crazier and, like, psycho about it.
Yeah, people were specifically avoiding going to Massachusetts just to dock because they would pull you off the ship and accuse you of witchcraft.
Witch!
No.
Keep her out of this town.
The real problem was not that someone was pretty. It was like, oh, what do they have on that ship? Oh, it's entirely full of tobacco?
It's something
everyone on here is a witch. Yeah. Now so, we, the state, get to take the tobacco. It's mine now.
So Grace Sherwood's story is well known in Virginia and celebrated annually in Pungo. Grace is an honorary official of the town's annual strawberry festival. In Williamsburg, there is a yearly reenactment of her trial, which I'm like, that's not really so remembering weird. Her well,
no,
but
that's
all right.
Really weird.
So Virginia Beach also holds a yearly reenactment, strange, which is held at the Ferry Plantation House.
Oh.
And then in 2006, during this reenactment, Mayor E. Obendorf? Sorry, okay. I can't tell you. Read the pardon for Grace Sherwood aloud. He also declared Sherwood... He also declared that July 10th, 300 years after her trial, 300 years to the day after her trial, be known as Grace Sherwood Day. So that same day, the governor of Virginia also pardoned Sherwood, and then the following year, a statue of Sherwood was unveiled in Virginia Beach.
So it was really upsetting that 300 years later is when she finally got pardoned.
I know. And that is the story of witchcraft in colonial Virginia.
I liked it.
And,
I liked your story.
A Thanksgiving tale in my mind. Because
it's in Virginia.
It doesn't matter. No, just because it deals with colonists.
No, that's fair. Yeah, the early colonists. That's Thanksgiving.
And it doesn't matter what time of year it is for them and what the stories are. That's Thanksgiving. Those are the Thanksgiving people.
I mean, technically, it's the Massachusetts ones. But
I know, but in my mind, it's all
They're all the same thing.
They're all the same.
They are all the same.
They are the same. They're all named James and Mary
and John.
So
those are all the only three names in the whole world then. And if you had any other name, a state got named after you because it was so surprising.
Yeah.
Like Carolina and Virginia.
Mm-hmm. What was I going to say? But yeah, I guess, I mean, I know of, you know, the Salem witch trials and whatever, but I guess I've never, like, looked into any of the other states of their witch trials that they had at that same time. Well, because, you know,
the thing.
There's not that many states that people there's were in at that
states
time.
There's not many states then. There's also not that many cases.
No. And if there were, we don't know about them.
Yeah. Because they all got burned.
The files got burned. Yeah.
It was Sherman. William Tecumseh Sherman that was burning the South. By the way, if you search...
Oh, yeah, definitely him.
The Raising of the South, it just brings up Lord of the Rings Shire information.
I mean, fair enough.
And yes, you're correct. The Shire did get raised. That was a problem in those books. But that's not usually what I mean when I type in the South.
Who does? Anyway, I guess for this Thanksgiving, we should all practice witchcraft. Because, you know, the way things are going, that might also get taken away from us.
That's soon. True. Do it while you can.
And also, just to upset the dead ones who didn't accept anything new in their lives.
Yeah. I strive to upset the dead ones.
Anyway, which, the dead ones practice witchcraft, so... Even if they didn't identify it that way.
Yep.
But yeah, I guess practice some witchcraft this Thanksgiving and try not to kill anybody and don't mess with Ouija boards. Bye.
The Pope is the biggest witch of them all.
Don't even get me started on the pedos of the Catholic Church. This is a Thanksgiving episode. So I'm just editing this today. And no, the speakers in your car aren't acting weird or, you know, whatever you're listening to on is fine. But for some reason, when we started mentioning upsetting past dead people, our microphone started acting weird. And as soon as we stopped talking about that, it ended. So a little bit spooky. Anyway, happy Thanksgiving. Bye.